So, imagine you are standing on the surface of this seemingly perfect planet.
Okay, setting the scene.
Right, like you had these vast rolling oceans of liquid water crashing against rocky shorelines. And you look up, and instead of a yellow sun, there's this massive, deep red star just dominating the sky.
Sounds incredibly sci-fi, honestly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And for a moment, you think you found it, you know, a second Earth, a quiet sanctuary in the TRAPPIST-1 system.
Right. But the data says otherwise.
Oh, totally. Because then, without warning, the sky flashes blinding white, the temperature violently spikes, and within hours, the oceans actually begin to boil, and you realize the atmosphere is literally being ripped into deep space.
It's brutal.
It is. You thought you were standing on a habitable world, but the James Webb Space Telescope just proved you're standing on a sterilized, irradiated rock.
Yeah, and it is a terrifying reality check, honestly. And it perfectly encapsulates this collision between our romanticized expectations of the universe and the just brutal, unforgiving nature of actual physical astrophysics.
Which brings us directly to the mission for today's deep dive. Because if you've grown up consuming popular science over the last few decades, you have been handed a very, well, a very comforting narrative.
Oh, for sure. The mediocrity principle.
Exactly, the mediocrity principle. You look up at the night sky, you see billions of stars, and the assumption is very democratic, right? Earth is just a typical rock orbiting a typical star in a typical galaxy.
The idea being that whatever happened here must be happening everywhere simply by the sheer weight of numbers.
Right. But today, we are going to subject that assumption to a mathematically rigorous, merciless audit. We're using chapter 3 of a really fascinating text called The Origin Enigma.
Which is such a great source because it takes the actual bleeding edge data from planetary geology, astrophysics, and of course the latest JWST observations.
Yeah, and we are going to use that data to dismantle this Copernican assumption piece by piece. We're going to physically zoom in for you guys.
Starting big.
Starting huge, the macroscopic scale of the Milky Way. And then we'll push down into stellar physics, break apart the architecture of our specific solar system, and finally, drill deep down into the geophysical core and the electromagnetic realities of this planet.
It's quite the journey.
It is. And the framing question we want you to hold in your mind as we take this journey is this. If the universe is supposedly teeming with life, why does every new piece of high-tech data make Earth look less like a standard template and more like a mathematical impossibility?
That is the big question.
Yeah.
And to start, before we can even look for planets, we have to look at the galactic zoning laws, so to speak.
Galactic zoning laws. I like that.
Right, because you cannot build a biological house if the neighborhood itself is a literal demolition zone. For decades, the guiding heuristic was the Drake equation.
Which was Carl Sagan's big thing.
Exactly. And the Drake equation starts by essentially throwing a net over all 100 billion stars in the Milky Way and just assuming, well, they are all viable candidates.
Right, because a star is a star. It provides heat, it provides gravity, it anchors a system. Why wouldn't it work?
That's the intuitive thought. But recent observational data heavily supports what Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee termed the rare earth hypothesis.
Okay, rare earth hypothesis. Break that down for us.
So it fundamentally shifts the paradigm by introducing the galactic habitable zone. The Milky Way is not just this uniform ocean of potential, it is defined by brutal opposing physical gradients.
Meaning you can't just set up shop anywhere.
Right. You are navigating two completely different lethal extremes, radiation and metallicity.
Okay, let's look at the galactic core first.
Yeah, the inner galaxy. It's incredibly dense. And the high stellar density sounds great for generating planets initially, but it means you have a massive frequency of type 2 supernovae.
Okay, let's pause and visualize a type 2 supernova for a second, because we aren't just talking about like a bright light in the sky. This is the cataclysmic core collapse of a massive star.
The most violent explosions in the universe.
Right, so what actually happens to a planetary atmosphere if one of these goes off within, say, 30 light years?
It is an atmospheric slaughter. There's no other word for it. The explosion releases this initial, just unimaginably intense wave of gamma radiation.
And gamma rays are bad news.
Very bad. When those gamma rays hit an Earth-like atmosphere, they completely alter the atmosphere chemistry. They ionize the nitrogen and oxygen, causing them to bond into nitrogen oxides.
Oh, wow.
And this chemical chain reaction aggressively eats the planet's ozone layer.
And without the ozone layer, the planet is just completely naked to ultraviolet radiation, right?
Stripped entirely bare. And the ozone layer doesn't just regenerate overnight. The planet is exposed to lethal UV and incoming cosmic radiation for centuries.
Wow.
Any complex surface biology is completely scorched. And furthermore, the inner galaxy is constantly bathed in high energy radiation from Sagittarius A star, which is the supermassive black hole right at the center.
But it's not just the radiation making the core dangerous, is it? It's also the gravitational chaos.
Oh, absolutely.
Because when you pack that many stars that closely together, they are constantly moving past one another.
They act like gravitational wrecking balls.
That's exactly it. They perturb the outer edges of whatever planetary systems exist there. They disturb the Oort clouds, those outer shells of icy debris, just sending endless extinction-level barrages of comets raining down on the inner rocky planets.
The center of the galaxy is effectively a perpetual sterilization zone. It is simply too chaotic.
So the galactic core is basically downtown Manhattan during an earthquake.
That's a good way to put it.
You step outside, you get hit by a cosmic bus. So logically, we retreat to the quiet countryside, right? We go to the outer rim of the galaxy, the outer 30% of the galactic disk. There are far fewer stars, far fewer supernovae. It's quiet.
It is completely quiet, but it's also dead.
Wait, dead? Why?
Because you run headfirst into the metallicity problem.
Ah, right.
In astrophysics, anything heavier than hydrogen and helium is referred to as metal, and the early universe only had hydrogen and helium.
So all the heavy stuff had to be made later.
Exactly. Every heavier element, iron, silicon, magnesium, carbon, phosphorus, all of it had to be forged in the nuclear furnaces of dying stars, in those very supernovae we were just trying to avoid.
Okay, I see the trap. So because the outer rim has so few massive stars exploding, it is extremely metal poor.
Yes. The interstellar dust clouds out there simply do not have the building materials to pour a planetary foundation.
Meaning, without heavy elements, a star system might manage to form some diffuse gas giants out of hydrogen and helium, but it physically cannot accrete a rocky planetary core.
Let alone a crust with the trace elements necessary for biological chemistry. You just cannot build a rocky planet out of hydrogen gas.
Right, right. So the center is a shooting gallery, and the outer rim is totally barren. That leaves us with the cosmic suburbs.
The sweet spot.
A narrow annular ring right in the middle of the Milky Way, where you have enough heavy metals from past supernovae to build a rock, but you are far enough away from the core to avoid being irradiated or gravitationally pulverized.
Yes, but look at what that single spatial filter does to the math. It's bad, isn't it?
Just demanding the correct galactic real estate instantly eliminates between 80 and 90% of all stars in the Milky Way.
Now, wait, let me push back on that a little bit.
Sure.
Because the Milky Way has roughly 100 billion stars. Even if we lose 90% right off the top, that still leaves us with 10 billion stars in the safe zone. 10 billion is a massive number. Surely out of 10 billion stars, the universe is still practically guaranteed to produce millions of Earths.
Well, that assumes all those remaining stars are capable of hosting life. And that brings us to the habitable star problem.
Okay, so we're filtering again.
We have to. Yeah. You cannot just drop a planet next to any star in the safe zone and expect it to work. We have to filter the remaining pool by stellar class.
Got it.
Let's start with the largest stars' spectral types, O, B, A, and F.
The massive, bright, blue and white giants. I mean, they have huge habitable zones because they throw off so much heat, right?
They do. But stellar physics dictates an inverse relationship between a star's mass and its lifespan, meaning the bigger they are, the faster they burn.
Exactly. Because they are so massive, gravity crushes their cores with immense pressure, causing them to burn through their nuclear fuel at just a terrifying rate. An O-type star might exhaust its hydrogen in a few million years. An A-type star might last a billion.
And let's look at the biological timeline here. It took approximately 3.5 billion years for complex multicellular life to evolve from single cells on Earth.
Right.
That means these massive stars are dead, they've gone supernova or collapsed before the biological plate can even get past the first act.
Precisely. They complete their entire life cycles before a planetary crust has even properly stabilized, let alone evolved a whole ecosystem. So time alone eliminates the upper end of the stellar spectrum.
So we cross the giants off the list entirely. What about the opposite extreme? The little guys. Red dwarfs, also known as M dwarfs.
Now these are incredibly important.
Yeah, because they make up roughly 75% of all stars in the universe.
Yeah.
And they burn their fuel very slowly, meaning their lifespans are measured in trillions of years.
Which sounds perfect for life.
Exactly. For a long time, the media and exoplanet hunters have treated M dwarfs as the absolute holy grail. We are constantly seeing headlines about Earth-like planets discovered around red dwarfs.
They are numerically abundant, and they offer practically infinite time. But the physical mechanics of orbiting a red dwarf are brutal.
Why is that?
Because the star is so dim and cool, its habitable zone, the orbital distance where liquid water could theoretically persist, is pulled incredibly close to the star, usually well under 0.1 astronomical units.
To put that in perspective for you listening, Mercury is about 0.4 astronomical units from our sun. So these planets are huddled right up against the fire just to keep from freezing.
And when you pull a planet that close to its host star, strong gravitational tidal forces take over.
Oh, tidal locking.
Yes. The difference in gravitational pull between the near side of the planet and the far side acts like a brake on the planet's rotation. Very quickly, the planet becomes tidally locked.
Which means the planet's rotation matches its orbit perfectly. One side is permanently facing the star in perpetual noon, and the other side is permanently facing deep space in perpetual freezing night.
And the temperature gradients alone from that would create supersonic global hurricane force winds, constantly howling from the day side to the night side.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It is, but the thermal extreme isn't even the primary reason JWST is changing the narrative.
Right. This goes back to the TRAPPIST-1 scenario we opened with. JWST has finally given us the instruments to actually look at the atmospheres of these red dwarf planets.
And what it's finding is absolute devastation.
Devastation how?
Well, M dwarfs are magnetically highly volatile, especially in their youth, which lasts for billions of years. They produce intense superflares. Our sun produces flares, sure, but M dwarf flares are orders of magnitude more powerful, and they happen constantly.
Just bombarding the planet?
Exactly. JWST data from 2023 and 2024 has confirmed the effects of the extreme X-ray and ultraviolet flux from these stars. It drives a process called photoevaporation.
Break down photoevaporation for us. How does light actually destroy an atmosphere?
The extreme ultraviolet radiation hits the molecules in the planet's upper atmosphere, things like water vapor, nitrogen, or carbon dioxide, with so much energy that it physically accelerates the particles past the planet's escape velocity.
Oh, wow. So they just shoot off into space.
Yeah. It acts like a blowtorch. It slowly and methodically strips the gaseous envelope away, molecule by molecule, until there's nothing left but bare rock.
And the TRAPPIST-1 system is the smoking gun for this, isn't it? We found 7 roughly Earth-sized planets there. Everyone was holding their breath.
The hype was unreal.
It really was. But JWST confirmed that the innermost planets, B and C, are airless rocks. And even the planets sitting right in the middle of the theoretical habitable zone, planets E, F, and G, show absolutely no evidence of the thick atmospheres required to maintain liquid surface water.
The habitable zone around a red dwarf is essentially a thermal mirage.
A thermal mirage. I love that phrasing.
It's true, though. The temperature parameters might technically allow for liquid water, provided you have an atmosphere to create pressure. But the radiation environment ensures you never actually get to keep one. The environment is biologically intolerable.
Okay, so if the massive giants die too fast and the red dwarfs strip their planets bare, what is actually left in our pool of 10 billion stars?
Only a very narrow, middle-of-the-road band of G-type stars, like our sun, and stable K-type stars.
And they make up less than 10% of the stellar population.
The math gets punishing very quickly. We lost 90% to the galactic zone, and now we lose another 90% of the survivors to the stellar class filter.
Wow. Okay, so we found the right star in the right neighborhood, but an entirely safe star does not guarantee a safe planetary system.
Not even close.
Right, because even if you have an Earth-sized rock in the perfect orbit, we have to look at the architecture of the solar system itself, because the inner solar system is naturally a chaotic shooting gallery.
You have a constant influx of comets from the outer reaches and asteroids from the inner belts. To have an environment stable enough for complex evolutionary biology to run for billions of years, you need a cosmic bouncer.
The Jupiter shield.
Precisely. You need a massive gravitational anchor sitting out in the perimeter of the solar system.
And Jupiter has a mass 318 times that of Earth. Its gravitational sphere of influence is just enormous.
It is. As comets fall inward toward the sun, Jupiter either absorbs the impacts directly, as we saw famously with the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet back in 1994, or its gravity slingshots them into completely different non-lethal orbits.
Or just ejects them from the solar system entirely.
Exactly.
So without Jupiter sweeping the orbital lanes, the rate of extinction-level impacts on Earth would be orders of magnitude higher, We wouldn't just have one dinosaur-killing asteroid every 100 million years. We'd be getting hit so often that the biosphere would be perpetually resetting to basic microbial life.
It completely forecloses the long-term stability required for complexity. But what is truly staggering is what happens when we compare our system to the exoplanet data we have gathered over the last 15 years.
Because we expected to see a lot of these cosmic bouncers sitting nicely in their outer orbits.
And we didn't. We saw the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah. The configuration of our solar system is exceptionally rare. The most commonly observed gas giant configuration is what astrophysicists call a hot Jupiter.
A hot Jupiter.
Right. These are massive gas giants that formed in the outer system, just like ours did. But due to friction with the early protoplanetary disk, they didn't stay put. They migrated inward toward their host star.
And as a planet 300 times the size of Earth moves through the inner solar system, its gravity basically acts like a snowplow.
It either rips apart any forming rocky terrestrial planets, or it gravitationally ejects them into deep space as rogue planets. So a system with small rocky planets safely huddled on the inside, and a well-behaved gas giant staying out on the perimeter acting as a shield. It's the statistical exception.
That is wild. Okay, let's talk about another piece of incredibly specific planetary architecture. The moon.
Our favorite satellite.
Right. Now, you look up at the moon, and it seems like a decorative accessory. It causes the tides, it gives us moonlight. But from a geophysical standpoint, the moon is an absolute necessity.
It is. Our moon is anomalously large. It is about 181st the mass of Earth.
Which doesn't sound that big until you compare it to others.
Exactly. If you look at other moons in our solar system, like the moons of Mars or Jupiter, they are microscopic fractions of their host planet's mass.
Right.
The French astronomer Jacques Lascar utilized chaos theory modeling to demonstrate exactly what Earth mechanics would look like without that massive lunar anchor.
And it comes down to the axial tilt, right? Right now, Earth tilts at 23.5 degrees.
Yep.
That gives us stable, mild seasons as we orbit the sun. What happens if you just delete the moon?
Without the moon's gravitational influence acting as a stabilizing flywheel, Earth's axial tilt would become chaotic over geological timescales. Lascar's math shows it would bounce erratically between 0 and 85 degrees, driven by the gravitational tugs of Jupiter and the Sun.
Bouncing between 0 and 85 degrees, let's visualize what an 85-degree tilt actually means for you and me. That means the planet is essentially knocked on its side, rolling like a barrel around the Sun, sort of similar to Uranus.
Exactly.
So if you were standing in North America, what does the sky actually look like?
Well, if the pole is pointing almost directly at the Sun, you would have regions of the planet enduring months where the sun literally never sets. It would sit at the zenith, blasting direct solar radiation until the oceans in that hemisphere boiled.
Just endless scorching noon.
Right. And then 6 months later, as the planet reaches the other side of its orbit, that same hemisphere would face deep space. You would endure months of absolute freezing, pitch black darkness.
The temperature swings would be so violent, moving from boiling to deep freeze every single year. A complex surface biosphere could never take hold. It would systematically destroy the food chain.
The moon locks us in. It is a precision gyroscope.
Okay, but even if we have the Jupiter shield and the massive moon, we still have to get the size of the Earth right. And this brings us to another major disappointment in the exoplanet data.
You're referring to the super-Earths.
Yes.
So the Kepler and TESS space telescopes revolutionized our understanding of planet populations. They revealed that the most common type of planet in the galaxy is actually something that doesn't even exist in our solar system. Planets between 1.5 and 4 times the radius of Earth.
And they always make incredible headlines. I remember when K2-18b was discovered, the media just lost its mind.
Oh, the biosignature hype.
Exactly. People were claiming they had found biosignatures,
right,
pointing to water vapor or methane. Everyone assumed it was just a slightly larger, slightly heavier version of Earth. More room for oceans, more room for life.
And that is a perfect example of how the media desperately wants to validate the mediocrity principle before the actual physical data comes in.
Right.
There is a severe, insurmountable architectural problem with super-Earths. The planetary radius distribution shows a distinct physical discontinuity at roughly 1.6 Earth radii.
A physical discontinuity.
Mm.
What actually happens when a rocky planet hits 1.6 Earth radii?
The planetary gravity crosses a critical threshold. During the formation of the solar system, when the planet is sweeping up material from the disk, its gravity is so strong that it doesn't just pull in rock. It retains a massive, thick envelope of raw hydrogen and helium gas.
Okay.
It doesn't become a big Earth. It effectively turns into a mini Neptune.
Meaning there's no solid surface you could actually stand on, or at least not one accessible to life.
Exactly. Let's look closely at K2-18b. The initial reports hypothesized atmospheric methane, leading to wild speculation about biology, but rigorous atmospheric modeling completely dismantled that.
What did the model show?
K2-18b has a massive hydrogen envelope, and that envelope creates thousands of atmospheres of pressure at the core boundary. Assuming there is even a rocky core under there, the pressure is so immense that any water doesn't exist as a liquid ocean. It transitions into a supercritical fluid.
Okay, explain a supercritical fluid. What does that mean for chemistry?
A supercritical fluid is this bizarre phase of matter that occurs past a specific temperature and pressure threshold, where it behaves with the density of a liquid but expands like a gas.
That is bizarre.
It is. And under those crushing pressures and temperatures, the fundamental rules of organic chemistry break down. Complex, delicate carbon-based molecules, the literal building blocks of biology, are physically impossible to form or maintain. They are just torn apart.
So true. Bare rocky planets with thin atmospheres, it turns out, are a tiny minority of the planetary population.
A very tiny minority.
Okay, before we push further down, let's run a mathematical reality check, because we have stacked filter upon filter here.
Let's run a highly conservative multiplication. We give a generous 1 in 10 chance, so 0.1, for a star being in the galactic habitable zone.
Yeah.
We give another 0.1 probability that it's a stable G or K type star.
Mm-hmm.
We assign a 0.1 probability of having a non-migrating Jupiter acting as a shield.
Still tracking.
We assign a 1 in 100 chance, 0.01, of a planetary collision creating a massive stabilizing moon without destroying the planet entirely. And we'll assign a 0.1 probability of a planet being the exact correct size to maintain a thin atmosphere and plate tectonics without becoming a mini Neptune.
And when you multiply 0.1 by 0.1 by 0.1 by 0.01 by 0.1,
you get 10 to the negative 6, a 1 in a million statistical anomaly.
Wow.
Out of a million stars, maybe one possesses the right real estate, the right stellar engine, the right solar system architecture, and the right mass.
And here's the kicker. We haven't even looked at the surface of the planet yet.
Not yet.
So let's zoom down to the crust and the core of the Earth itself. Because as Chapter 3 of the Origin Enigma outlines, Earth is not just a passive rock waiting for life to happen. It is a highly calibrated, actively running geochemical engine. And the first thing we have to audit is water.
This is perhaps one of the most counterintuitive pieces of the puzzle. The universal mantra in astrobiology is follow the water.
Right. Water is the universal solvent. It facilitates all biological chemistry. So the logical assumption is, if water is good, a planet completely covered in an ocean that is hundreds of miles deep must be paradise.
The water world.
Yeah, a water world should be teeming with life.
It seems completely logical, but rigorous geophysical modeling reveals the water world trap. Earth is actually anomalously dry by the standards of planetary formation.
Wait, anomalously dry?
Yes. Consider this. The oceans look vast to us, but water makes up only about 0.02% of Earth's total mass.
Wait, 0.02%? That sounds impossible. The surface is 70% covered in oceans.
The surface is covered, yes, but it's just a microscopic film of moisture on a massive ball of dense iron, nickel, and silicate rock. It is incredibly delicate.
Wow.
Now, as we discussed, planets often migrate inward during formation. When planets form further out, past the snow line, where water freezes into ice, they sweep up massive amounts of frozen water. When they migrate inward, they often end up with water comprising 10% to 50% of their total mass.
Okay, so we take one of these migrating planets, have 10% water mass, the ice melts.
Yes.
You don't have oceans that are a few miles deep, like the Marianas Trench. You have oceans that are hundreds of kilometers deep.
Yes.
What actually happens at the bottom of an ocean that deep?
You run into a catastrophic physical problem. The hydrostatic pressure of hundreds of kilometers of water pushing down is immense. Even if the water at the bottom is physically hot from the planet's core, the pressure overrides the temperature.
The pressure overrides the heat.
Exactly. It forces the liquid water molecules to compress and lock into exotic high-pressure crystalline phases of ice, specifically known as Ice 6 and Ice 7.
Let me make sure I'm hearing this right. The pressure is so extreme that it forces the water into a solid, rigid lattice, meaning you literally have a massive shell of solid ice sitting at the bottom of a boiling hot ocean.
Exactly. It creates a planetary-scale, completely impenetrable barrier of solid ice separating the liquid ocean from the rocky mantle.
And why is that a death sentence for life?
Because life requires more than just water. It requires chemical nutrients. phosphorus, sulfur, iron, magnesium.
Right.
On Earth, we have the carbon silicate weathering cycle.
Right.
Rainwater dissolves atmospheric carbon dioxide, creating a weak acid that weathers exposed continental rock. The runoff carries those dissolved minerals into the oceans. Furthermore, ocean water interacts directly with the rocky crust at hydrothermal vents along tectonic ridges, dissolving essential trace metals.
So that interaction, the wet rock meeting the liquid water, is what cycles the actual chemistry of life.
Right. But on a water world, the ice-7 barrier completely seals off the rock. The water never touches the mantle. No rocks dissolve into the water. The carbon silicate cycle is completely shut down.
So the entire global ocean is geochemically starved.
It is a giant, sterile swimming pool. Earth is balancing perfectly on an absolute knife edge. We accreted exactly enough water to maintain life-sustaining oceans, but we remain dry enough to allow vast continents of exposed rock to breach the surface and drive geochemical cycling.
We are balancing on a tightrope. But the tightrope goes even deeper. Let's talk about the radioactive heat budget of the planet, because Earth has an internal battery, right? We have the core.
We do. And Earth's internal heat is non-negotiable. That heat drives convection in the liquid outer core, which generates the geodynamo, our magnetic shield.
And without the magnetic field, the solar wind just strips our atmosphere.
Exactly. The heat also drives the convective currents in the mantle, which power plate tectonics. Tectonics act as a long-term thermostat, recycling carbon and regulating the global climate over billions of years. Without this internal heat, the planet dies.
But the Earth has been radiating heat into space for 4.5 billion years. The residual heat from the planetary collisions that formed the Earth should have dissipated long ago. So what is actually keeping the battery charged?
Roughly half of Earth's internal heat right now comes from the slow nuclear decay of very specific, long-lived radioactive isotopes in the mantle and crust, primarily uranium-238, thorium-232, and potassium-40.
Okay.
As these atoms decay, they release alpha particles that collide with surrounding rock, generating heat. They are a slow-release thermal battery.
And where do those heavy radioactive isotopes come from? Because you mentioned earlier that supernovae only make elements up to about iron or slightly heavier.
They are forged almost exclusively in the most violent, extreme events in the universe, neutron star mergers. The R-process nucleosynthesis required to pack that many neutrons into a single nucleus only happens when two dead, ultra-dense stellar cores collide. And because neutron star mergers are relatively rare, these isotopes are distributed through the galaxy in a highly uneven, patchy manner.
So it's a cosmic lottery. When the dust cloud that formed the Earth was spinning, we just happened to sweep up the exact right amount of uranium-thorium dust.
Yep.
Let's play with the dials here. What happens if our cloud had slightly less of these isotopes?
Well, if Earth accreted slightly less of this radioactive fuel, the planetary core would have cooled and solidified billions of years ago.
And then what?
The convection stops, the geodynamo shuts down, the magnetic shield drops, the solar wind immediately begins stripping the atmosphere, the carbon cycle halts, the planet freezes solid and becomes a geologically dead world, exactly like Mars.
Mars is what happens when the radioactive battery dies. Okay, so we dialed it the other way.
Right.
What if the dust cloud had a slightly higher concentration of uranium and thorium? More heat is better, right?
Emphatically no. If we had a higher concentration, the mantle would remain excessively hot and highly viscous. The crust would be incredibly thin and unstable.
Meaning lots of volcanoes.
You would have hyperactive continuous volcanism across the entire surface of the planet. These constant supervolcanoes would choke the atmosphere with sulfur dioxide and massive amounts of ash.
Which blocks out the sun.
It would block all photosynthesis. And the massive outgassing of carbon dioxide would create an unstoppable runaway greenhouse effect. The planet boils, exactly like Venus.
So Earth is literally threading the needle. We are balancing between freezing to death like Mars and boiling to death like Venus, maintained purely by the random cosmic lottery of how much radioactive dust from a distant neutron star collision we happened to scoop up 4.5 billion years ago.
A hardware is just astoundingly specific.
It is. But okay, so we have this perfectly calibrated stage. We have the star, the orbit, the Jupiter shield, the exact water ratio, the perfect radioactive battery. The stage is set. But Earth has been sitting here for 4 billion years. Hasn't the environment changed? How did the stage not break down over that kind of deep time?
Time is the ultimate silent filter. And this brings us to the work of geophysicist David Waltham and the concept of survivor bias.
Explain survivor bias, because usually we hear about the Gaia hypothesis, the idea that Earth's biosphere is like a living organism that naturally regulates its own climate. If things get too hot, life adjusts to cool it down. It makes it sound like stability is built into the system.
Waltham rejects the Gaia hypothesis entirely. Planetary climates are not inherently self-correcting. They are highly chaotic, non-linear systems. Let's look at a massive external variable, the faint young sun paradox.
What's the paradox?
Over the last 4 billion years, as the sun has aged and hydrogen fusion has altered its core density, its luminosity, its sheer heat output has increased by approximately 30%.
30% is a massive planetary scale change. A 30% increase in solar energy should have boiled the Earth's oceans hundreds of millions of years ago.
It absolutely should have. In a typical planetary model, a change of that magnitude triggers feedback loops that inevitably collapse the system. If it gets slightly too cold, ice caps grow. Ice reflects sunlight albedo, making it colder, creating more ice, until the planet falls into a runaway glaciation, a snowball Earth.
Right.
If it gets slightly too hot, more water evaporates. Water vapor is a potent greenhouse gas, which traps more heat, evaporating more water, until you reach a runaway greenhouse state. The regulatory feedback mechanisms eventually fail under extreme pressure.
So why did they fail here? Why hasn't Earth boiled or frozen permanently in 4 billion years?
Waltham argues it is pure survivor bias. We observe a 4 billion year continuous record of climatic stability, not because Earth has some magical inherent regulatory immunity, but because out of millions of planets, we are the one extreme statistical anomaly where chaotic, random fluctuations in biology, geology, and solar output happen to perfectly, coincidentally, cancel each other out over deep time.
Wow. We are the lottery winner, looking at our ticket, and assuming the game must be easy to win simply because we are the ones holding the ticket.
Precisely. The fact that we survived 4 billion years of chaotic climate shifts is a statistical miracle, not a biological law.
That is terrifying. It means we have been walking a tightrope blindfolded, and we just happen to never misplace a foot.
Exactly.
But there is another temporal coincidence here, brought up by astrophysicist John Griven. And this highlights the sheer terrifying timing of our existence. We didn't just survive the past. We are pushing right up against the edge of the future.
Griven points out a profound, sobering temporal convergence. As we noted, the sun's luminosity is continuing to increase. Stellar evolution models predict that within 500 million to 1 billion years from now, this increasing solar radiation will cross a critical threshold.
What happens then?
It will trigger a moist greenhouse effect. It will begin to evaporate the oceans into the upper atmosphere, where solar radiation will split the water into hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen will escape into space, and the oceans will be lost forever.
So the biosphere is permanently sterilized in roughly 500 million years. The clock is ticking.
Very loudly. Now map that onto the total timeline. Earth formed roughly 4.5 billion years ago. It will die in roughly 500 million. That gives Earth a total habitable lifespan of about 5 billion years from beginning to end.
And it took us exactly 4.5 billion years to get here. From single-celled archaea, through the Cambrian explosion, through multiple mass extinctions, to finally arriving at a complex technological intelligence capable of understanding the universe, we arrived at the very end of the party.
We appeared at the absolute edge of the planet's viable temporal window. Consider the margin of error here. If the chaotic, meandering process of evolutionary history had been delayed by just 10% of its actual duration,
a 10% delay over a 4.5 billion year timeline,
the biosphere would have been sterilized by the dying sun before human intelligence ever had a chance to arise. The timing of our existence is just as perilously fine-tuned as the gravity of Jupiter or the radioactive decay of the core.
Okay, we have covered the macroscopic scales. We've done the galaxy, the stellar physics, the planetary architecture, the geophysical core, and the dimension of deep time. For the final piece of the puzzle, I want to take us in the exact opposite direction.
The quantum scale.
I want to zoom into the smallest physical scale yet, the physics of light, molecular bonds, and quantum mechanics. Because the sources reveal a coincidence here that, quite frankly, defies all naturalistic explanation.
You are referring to molecular biologist Michael Denton's analysis of the electromagnetic spectrum. This is where the fine-tuning of the physical universe becomes almost eerie in its precision.
Exactly. Denton's electromagnetic convergence. Let's break this down. The electromagnetic spectrum is vast. It encompasses all forms of light and radiation in the universe.
Right.
It spans roughly 70 octaves.
Right.
Think of it like a piano keyboard that stretches for miles. On one end, you have incredibly high energy gamma rays with wavelengths smaller than an atom. On the other end, you have radio waves, which can have wavelengths the size of skyscrapers.
70 octaves of radiation. But for complex carbon-based life to exist, 4 physically entirely unrelated systems in nature must independently synchronize on one incredibly narrow specific band of that massive spectrum, visible light.
Which is wavelengths between 0.4 and 0.7 micrometers.
Right.
Visible light is essentially just one single key on that miles-long piano keyboard. And yet, everything hinges on it. Let's look at the 4 independent systems. First, the star.
Our sun is a massive ball of fusing plasma. Its surface temperature is roughly 5,778 Kelvin. According to Wien's displacement law in physics, that specific temperature dictates that its peak radiation emission, the vast majority of the light it throws into space, falls exactly within that tiny sliver of the visible light band.
Okay, so the sun's engine is perfectly tuned to broadcast primarily on that one specific frequency. Second, the atmosphere.
Earth's atmosphere is an ocean of gases. And due to the quantum mechanics of how gases absorb radiation vibrational modes for infrared, electronic transitions for ultraviolet, the atmosphere is almost completely opaque to the vast majority of those 70 octaves.
So most radiation can't get through.
Right. Gamma rays, X-rays, most ultraviolet, most infrared, they hit the atmosphere and are blocked or absorbed. But the atmosphere possesses a highly precise transparency window. It naturally allows visible light to pass straight through to the surface unimpeded.
So the sky acts as a physical, impenetrable wall to almost the entire spectrum, except for this one specific frequency, which just happens to be the exact frequency the sun is broadcasting at peak intensity.
Exact.
That's 2 systems. Third, the water.
Liquid water behaves in the exact same manner. Water is highly opaque to almost the entire electromagnetic spectrum. If you shine infrared or ultraviolet light into water, it is absorbed almost immediately.
Okay.
But water is remarkably uniquely transparent specifically to visible light. This is what allows sunlight to penetrate the upper layers of the ocean and drive marine photosynthesis, which is the foundational base of the entire global food chain.
Okay, so the sun broadcasts it, the air lets it through, the water lets it through, and the fourth system.
The chemistry, the building blocks of life.
Mm.
The energy of a visible light photon is roughly 2 to 3 electron volts. This is a highly specific, very narrow energy level, and it perfectly matches the energy required to drive biological electron transitions.
Like the photochemistry that powers photosynthesis in plants.
Exactly, or the molecular changes that allow the retina in your eye to actually see.
But it doesn't just power the chemistry. It powers it safely. Explain the threshold of carbon bonds to us.
Well, all organic chemistry relies on the atomic strength of carbon-carbon covalent bonds. If a photon has too much energy, like ultraviolet radiation or X-rays, it causes photodissociation.
Yeah.
It literally shatters those carbon bonds and destroys the complex molecules, causing mutations or death. If a photon has too little energy, like microwaves or infrared, it cannot trigger the necessary chemical reactions. It only vibrates the molecules, which just heats things up. Visible light has the exact quantum energy required to power complex biological chemistry without exceeding the threshold that would destroy the organism.
Let me synthesize this, because this is where the mind just sort of reels. We're talking about 4 completely separate domains of physics. Stellar physics, which determines the sun's temperature and blackbody radiation curve.
Mm.
Atmospheric quantum mechanics, which determines what frequencies gases absorb. The thermodynamic and optical properties of liquid water. And the atomic strength of carbon covalent bonds.
Right.
There is no underlying physical law forcing these 4 things to align.
None whatsoever. They are completely independent variables. You cannot derive the transparency of liquid water from the surface temperature of the sun. They are uncoupled realities.
And it's like 4 different people living in 4 different countries, entering 4 completely different lotteries, and all of them pulling the exact same winning number on the exact same day. There is no causal mechanism connecting them.
And yet, if even one of those 4 properties didn't align perfectly on that exact sliver of the 70 octave spectrum, complex life is impossible. If the sun burned hotter, if water absorbed visible light, if carbon bonds were slightly weaker, the whole system fails. They just happen to perfectly interlock to permit biology.
That is the inescapable reality of the physical data. When you audit the parameters, the concept of a typical Earth collapses under the weight of required precision.
It really does.
We need to step back and look at the cumulative verdict here. Because we have covered an immense amount of ground, from the macroscopic down to the quantum.
Let's synthesize the deep dive. We started with the stated mission of auditing the mediocrity principle, the comforting idea that Earth is typical.
And what did we find?
We found that the galactic habitable zone filters out 90% of stars. Stellar physics and M-dwarf superflares filter out 90% of the remainder. You need the statistically rare Jupiter shield to stop comet barrages. You need the rare, massive, stabilizing moon to lock the axial tilt. You need a planet sized perfectly to avoid the mini Neptune trap. You need to balance on the knife edge of being a dry rock water world, avoiding the catastrophic ice 7 barrier. You need the exact radioactive battery of uranium and thorium to drive the geodynamo without causing Venus-like volcanism.
It's just astonishing.
You need a chaotic climate to miraculously cancel itself out for 4 billion years. You need complex life to race against the expanding, dying sun and win at the last possible second. And underneath it all, you need the sun, the atmosphere, the water, and the carbon atom to independently synchronize their quantum properties on a single sliver of light.
When you take all of those independent probabilities and multiply them together, the Copernican assumption simply shatters. Earth is not a norm. It is not a standard template. It is an extreme, mathematically astonishing, statistical outlier.
Absolutely.
The idea that we are just a run-of-the-mill rock in a run-of-the-mill universe simply does not survive a rigorous audit of the physical data.
It does not. The physical stage is so heavily constrained, so incredibly specifically calibrated across every conceivable metric, that it demands we reevaluate how we view the origin of what happens on that stage.
And that brings us to the final provocative thought I want to leave you with today as we wrap up this deep dive. We have spent this entire time talking about the physical environment, the rocks, the gravity, the water, the isotopes, the light, the hardware of the planet.
Right, the hardware.
But think about this. If we are forced by the hard data to accept that the lifeless physical stage required for biology is this statistically impossible to build by chance, what does that mean for the actual actors on the stage?
That is the ultimate question.
If the chemistry of the universe can barely manage to construct a habitable rock, how on earth is it supposed to write the digital information dense code of DNA?
If assembling the environment is this statistically constrained, the leap from a habitable rock to actual biological information is a chasm of an entirely different order of magnitude.
Exactly. The hardware is a miracle of physics, but the software is a completely different mystery. I want you to keep thinking critically. Question the assumptions you're handed in a world of constant information overload. We promise you, our next deep dive is going to plunge exactly into that question, the digital code of life itself. Until then, keep looking up.